Okay. I'm Jonathan. I'm an alcoholic. I too was asked today. I have no idea what I'm going to say, so this is an adventure for everybody. Let me start with my sobriety date is July 13th, 2009. That makes me almost 4.5 years sober. I am the chair of Swacky Paw. I've had a number of other service positions. I've sponsored people. They don't stick around, but I've sponsored them. And I have a sponsor. So all of that is just to tell you that things work out. Rewind about 21 years, or even further. I grew up in Southern California. I was raised by my mom with my sister. My dad lived with my stepmom and eventually my half-brother about an hour north of us. And so I was split between my Monday through Friday home in one place and then on the weekends in another. And in Southern California, an hour is a huge difference in worlds. It meant different manners, different behavior, different expectations. I don't know if that matters. We'll see. Things were good for those first 10 years or so. I don't think I was different in any way. I think I was having a wonderful time. I was told that I was a very bright kid and put into advanced placement classes and told about my wonderful potential. And there was a little bit of a wrinkle. My parents, my teachers at one point asked my mom how she put up with me. Apparently I was difficult to keep focused, and they said that I was a handful. I don't know why, but that I got their jokes so that it was okay. I've always gotten along with people who were not my age group. Even when I came into AA, it took me a long time to come to meetings with young people or people my own age. I didn't trust you. My home group is Park City Men's Stag in Park City. Mostly old people, very comfortable there. So anyway, jumping around, that's probably going to happen a lot. Around midway through third grade, I had a verbally abusive teacher. He did not like me wandering around class, which I did whenever I was not interested in what was happening. This was before anybody knew anything about ADHD. There wasn't Ritalin popping out of vending machines, basically. So I just couldn't sit still. And he could not handle it. So one day he kind of snapped and sent me outside for a little timeout. And a few minutes later came out and told me, he had a piece of paper and he told me that I had earned this certificate for helping some of the disabled kids at the school. And that he had to sign it for me to actually get it, but that he wasn't going to sign it because I didn't deserve it. He didn't know how I had gotten it, but that I was obviously lying, deceiving people because I was a bad kid and just did not deserve praise or attention or anything like that. And he tore up the paper in front of me and left me outside for what felt like an eternity. And I learned from that a lesson that still sometimes persists today, that who I appear to be to people is not the true me, that no matter what good people say about me, I had for a long time a crushing sense of inadequacy and guilt and shame. Pretty soon after that, I sort of had as much of a breakdown as a kid can have. I started getting into a lot of fights. Midway through fourth grade, I was forcibly transferred to another school. fighting increased there, but and I started to get suspended a lot. I just didn't understand what was happening. Like, suddenly my world was just turned upside down. I didn't know how to react to that, and I was just generally confused by the world. Somewhere in there, I discovered my first addiction, which was online computer games. And it wasn't until I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for a few months, reading the doctor's opinion, that I understood that my addiction began at this age. I had thought that it was, when I came to AA, that it was just a recent development, that my drinking and pot smoking, that was my addiction. Instead, it spanned back here. Because apparently it is not normal to rack up $300 to $400 AOL bills every month and to be told not to play, and yet with hands shaking, reaching out to the computer to log in, and as soon as I was in, to have this amazing feeling of relief and of ease and comfort, the exact same way that the book and people in AA meetings describe their first drink. And the ones after that when things were still fun. I was just able to assume another identity, and if things got weird, new account, new character, new identity. Anonymity has always been a very good friend of mine. It was how I separated myself from other people and was able to only show the parts that I wanted to. The people I played with always assumed that I was somewhere between 30 and 40. I was happy with that. And because I got acceptance in this other world, I said screw it to the real world. I didn't have any friends, and I didn't miss them. Later on in life, I would describe friends as people who stole from you and resented you when you changed. I just did not care for the situation. So it wasn't until high school, sometime around 14 or 15, that I did start to make friends. I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't know what hanging out meant. Or what's up, or the facial gesture that goes with that meant. Like, I was completely surprised by a social life. And it was awkward and uncomfortable, and I didn't understand why people were trying to be my friend. By all accounts, I shouldn't have had friends. I was studying Latin, for Christ's sake. I was in the Latin club, and this is not a place where, you know, you're the popular kid. But I don't know. I made friends despite my best efforts. But I didn't understand why I had friends. And I was constantly afraid that they were going to discover the real self. The jerk, the inadequate person that I really was. And so when I was 16 and a friend of mine asked if I wanted to drink, I said sure, except I think what he asked was if I wanted to get drunk, and I said sure to that. From the very beginning, with alcohol, I was not interested in just drinking. Who would? It tastes awful. Especially since my first drink was Goldschlager with a grapefruit juice chaser. And that was interesting in and of itself. I was a little bit of background to this moment. I was raised a good Mormon kid. I did not swear. I did not ditch. As far as I was concerned, I did not do anything wrong. I was sweetness and light. And in this moment, I almost instantly abandoned all of my morals and upbringing, because to me, this was how I was going to keep my friends. And also, I tasted the Goldschlager. It was absolutely disgusting. And my first reaction in my head was, I'm going to have to get used to this taste eventually. I might as well figure out something now. I don't know where that came from, other than, I suppose, alcoholism. So I found the grapefruit juice. I hate grapefruit juice. But you do what you got to do. I don't remember anything after those first few drinks and going to the jacuzzi behind my house. There must have been more stuff going on. I didn't get sick. I just don't remember the rest of what happened. I don't remember the chronology, if it was before or after that, but right around that time, I was still playing the games. I only had enough energy for one addiction at a time. And by then, the internet had switched to unlimited. And so I was playing a lot more with almost no consequences, except for people constantly bugging me and saying, you play too much and we're worried about you and whatever. You know, if there had been internet rehabs back then, I think there's two now, but if it had been as much of a thing as alcohol and drug rehabs, where I probably would have been sent to wilderness into one of those things because it was just out of control. So when I had that drink, which was, in retrospect, obviously alcoholic, I didn't have the time or energy to focus on that. I was playing, but I think at some point there was this window of opportunity. Like, I'd gotten sick of the games. It had never occurred to me to quit, except to this point. Like, I never saw it as a problem, but at some point it was just causing me trouble. I wasn't having any fun. I didn't want to play, and I couldn't stop. Like, when I was younger, it was just automatic. I played even though I was told not to. But this had gotten to the point where I didn't want to of my own volition, and wasn't able to stop. But somehow I managed to rally enough willpower to log off, maybe delete the game. I don't know what I tried to control it, but maybe it was just because I had friends and things were working out, and I wanted to try and live something like a normal life. The problem was, one of these friends learned about one of the games that I had played, and he was starting to play it and having fun, and he got his brother into it, and I would watch them and kind of have the euphoric recall, a lot of nostalgia, and also a little bit of judgment because they were playing wrong. And I'm like, step aside. I will tell you how it is done. And then we were playing together, and then their play level sort of plateaued, and I went right back into the amount that I wanted to play. Fast forward a little bit, a few years to, I was 19, I think. I graduated high school a little bit early, because who needs that in their life? If you can get out early, do it. And I was working in a movie theater, and one of the guys that worked there was insane. And he was into a lot of drugs and probably drinking. I wasn't really aware of the full picture of what he was doing at the time, but years later, I found out he'd been in Narcotics Anonymous for 2.5 years. He was taking all kinds of antipsychotics and mood stabilizers. That he was not a well person. So along comes I, however you say that, and he's relapsing. And my other friends had sort of moved on a little bit, or at least I wasn't hanging out with them. And so I was making a new friend, and it was time again to compromise what I wanted to, who I wanted to be, in order to make and keep a friend. And he asked if I wanted to try this drug, LSA. It's a hallucinogenic. I didn't know what it was, but the obvious answer was absolutely. And so We did that. It was absolutely disgusting. Wandering around various cities of Orange County, fading in and out of reality, having at first a wonderful time, and around hour 10 just thinking, I want this to be over, and having to deal with another 4 hours of it. At the end of that, I just thought that I'm really, really glad I did that. I never, ever want to do it again. So halfway through the second time of doing it, throwing up in an intersection somewhere in Huntington Beach, I hated what I was doing. But then a guy in the car next to me said, what, did you have one too many beers? And then I hated him more than I hated me. Because, no, I don't drink beer. How dare you? I'm just on a hallucinogenic in the middle of the day for no good reason. And that's when his parents, who were, I think, in Al-Anon, 12-stepped me and said, you are enabling our son's drug use. And I called my dad later and asked him, what does enablement mean? And he just took on this tone of disappointment. Said, oh, Jonathan, what are you doing? So they told me, I think they told me about Al-Anon. Someone told me about Al-Anon. And I went there, and I was told that, so I walked in the room, I'm terrified. This is the same experience as my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think because I belonged there and identified with everything that was being said, and I did not want people to confront me and confirm my suspicions. And thankfully, not thankfully, the person I talked to at the end said Al-Anon was for friends and family of alcoholics only. I learned much, much later that that's just not true. Like, singleness of purpose has its limits. I was not in a mental state to say, okay, could you direct me to the Narcanon meetings? That was my one chance. I had been to an NA meeting with my friend, and that scared the hell out of me because I hadn't done anything that allowed me to identify with those people. Jail and stealing and misery. It's like, who does that? You people are sick. But then in the Al-Anon meeting, I don't know what was said, but those were my people. So eventually that friendship fell apart. It was just too chaotic to sustain itself. I made some other friends that, it was just kind of more of the same. It was chaotic. There was drinking, drug use. It was boring. Things got, a little bit worse, but mostly things were the same. And by the time I was 22, I had decided that it was my life in California that was the problem. I just needed to have a goal of some sort. I think the only goal I had was in high school, or in middle school, to be a Marine, because my one sort of friend was the janitor at the school who was teaching me about computers. And I mean, people at that point were literally telling me, we hate you, stop talking to us, go away. That was around the time of the fighting and the suspensions and reinforcing the idea of who needs friends. Who the hell are these people? So I wanted to be a Marine. Was the only example, which was kind of messed up because I was also in this situation with the principal of the school who was an ex-Marine. This was a place where if you used the word like incorrectly, you did 10 push-ups. So we were all very fit and very, very resentful. Somewhere in high school, I began to, I didn't come out of the closet, but as soon as I heard the word gay and understood what that meant, it was like, yeah, that's me. And then I made a connection with the don't ask, don't tell, and the, oh, you can't be gay in the military. I guess that one plan for my life is not working out. So I just ended up in community college. Nothing against community college. It was great. But then I'm 22, no purpose in life and stuck in community college. If you've seen the show Community, it's like that, but without the comedy. I met another person at the same job as the earlier guy, except this guy, in the language I know now, had what I wanted. He was just happy and did goofy stuff and was always smiling and was reading Moby Dick on purpose. No one was making him do it for school. It was just for fun. And I admired that kind of, I don't know what it was, that energy and ability to be in life and choose something like that. And when he wasn't reading Moby Dick, he was at Demolition Derbies. And so I just grilled him, like, tell me all about your life and what you're doing. And turned out he was at that job as a summer thing that he went to BYU. Mormon, and had been on a mission, and I just thought, I've never really given Mormonism the full effort. I still went to church, I still believed in everything, but there was, at that point, there was Prop 22 in California, the first no marriage for gays, and I guess technically that's an outside issue as far as the meeting goes, but you can imagine I don't support the thinking behind it. And so church became kind of a toxic place for me. Some very ugly things were said in our meetings, and I just knew that they were wrong, but that I couldn't keep being part of that. So meeting this guy and hearing about his life, I decided to give it another chance to move to Utah and be among my people and see what that was like. And this plan sort of... as we were, I met him when I was 21 and actually decided to have this plan. A year later, when he came back, I realized I forgot to do it and was still stuck in this horrible life. And then he went back to BYU a few months later. I still hadn't done anything. And January of 2004, my great aunt, who lived in Salt Lake City, died. And I came here for her funeral, and the emotional wreck that I was at the time sort of looked around at my life, and I was filled with regret for not having gotten to know her. And I just didn't want to have more regret at not pulling the trigger on this potential for a wonderful life. So I came home. I went around to all my teachers, begged them for improvements to my grades, and transferred to BYU. And I kind of, it's half funny and half awful, but I forgot to tell my friends that I was moving and that they would never see me again. We were out to dinner the night before I moved, and one of my friends in the parking lot afterwards said, see you later. And I said, oh, wait, no, you won't. I'm moving tomorrow. That's, I guess, how much regard I had for those relationships, how selfish and self-obsessed I was. And the next morning, I drove away in my packed Volkswagen Beetle, the first of probably six trips to move all my stuff. That's not a big car. And and I moved to Provo and attempted to start a new life. I started going to BYU as a guest student. And everything was going fine, except it was just a little weird acclimating. I was at that point really going crazy with the games. I was playing one called EverQuest. It's also called EverCrack. I was playing 15 hours a day every day. I had taken a semester off of my community college to really focus on what mattered. And I saw no problem with that still. So when I moved to Provo, that's what was taking up my time. I didn't see the need to make any new friends, and I was just trying to get my grades up to be able to stay there, because at the end of the spring and summer terms, I had to apply to be a full-time student, and I needed a high GPA to make that happen. At the end of August of 04, I did that, and they rejected me. I also walked into a blood drive to try and give blood. My mom's a nurse. I was raised to, you know, be a organ donor and give blood. Except apparently, if you're gay and you've acted on it, you can't give blood to the Red Cross. So I got a nice little letter saying no thanks. And my bishop at BYU had told me that he didn't really know what to do with me as a gay man. He just said, I don't have experience with this, so I'm just going to have to put you on probation. They call it probation. It's just you can't really participate. You can go to church, but you can't like have the sacrament and do all the churchy stuff. And so I had another little mini breakdown. In my mind, I had been rejected mentally, spiritually, and bodily, and I couldn't go back home. I didn't want to go back to that life. And so I asked my cousin who lived in Salt Lake, who was going to school there, about her college. She told me a little bit about it, and through another very rapid series of coincidences, I ended up in Salt Lake going to Westminster and getting an apartment right next to Fellowship Hall, one of the AA clubs here. I didn't know what it was. I actually thought it was like a Korean church, and I just instinctively stayed away. I never bothered to read the sign, the great big sign on the front doors, or on the front of the building. So I started my third college. I wasn't drinking, because you can't drink and go to BYU. And I certainly was not doing drugs. Within a semester, though, of going to Westminster, I was drinking again and smoking pot. Same pattern. I made new friends. I was wandering around campus drunk the night before Oktoberfest and met some people and decided to be their friend. Just sort of went along that same pattern until I graduated. My drinking and drug use did not interfere with my academics. I just loved school. I wouldn't let it get in the way. But towards the end of it, I had gotten sick of the games again. There was no fun at all anymore. It was constant frustration. Something to do with me being an asshole to everybody all the time. Nobody wanted to play with me, and so it was just like, screw you. So when I graduated, I didn't have anything to occupy my time. That's when I committed to the drinking and the drugs, mostly the drinking. I found that I couldn't do drugs during the week and still function at my job. So I would drink a little bit, but come the weekends, I would drink a lot, drink until I couldn't, and smoke a lot of pot. I got a job that was very technical. I had an English degree. I don't know why I got a technical job, but whatever. Still have it today. And my life was just sort of boring. I developed a love obsession for one of my friends. This is, I think, if you're counting my fourth addiction. I don't think I have time to really go into that, but it got to the point where I was ready to kill myself. I was smoking pot on a daily basis just to be able to eat and to smile on any level. I told someone that I was never going to be happy again, to give me a break, and I just couldn't stand to be me, but I didn't really have a choice. I was too depressed to kill myself, and I was just wandering aimlessly. I had a brilliant idea, I think in May of 2009, to go to the desert and fast and pray just like they did in the Bible and talk to God and try and figure out what the hell was going on. And so I went to Goblin Valley with a bunch of friends and I did that, and don't do that. I drank a lot of water, ended up going into shock from not having any electrolytes and not eating anything and it being really, really hot. And that just told me, I didn't see that that was a bad idea. I saw that it was just God's not talking to me. And that had been the situation for a long time. I couldn't not believe in God, but it was just that we didn't care for each other. We were not on speaking terms. And I've skipped a lot of stuff. I don't know if it's important. Life had been pretty bad that year. I had had 3 mental breakdowns. One of them, I couldn't eat solid foods for a month. I was on lithium and other antidepressants. The daily pot smoking was part of my attempts to augment that regime to stay alive, even though I didn't want to. And throughout there, randomly, people in AA started to infiltrate my life. Not directly, they were like friends of friends, and they were good examples. They were just good people. I liked hanging out with them. I didn't make the connection that they were in AA and therefore like that had made them good people. I didn't have any concept of recovery. I knew what AA was from my previous attempts at Al-Anon and going to that NA meeting. So it wasn't like a total shock at their existence. But a friend of mine had come over to my house at one point. He was someone that I used to drink with a lot. He had been to rehab a couple of times and he was sober. And he asked me if I thought I might be addicted to pot. And I said, maybe. I don't know why I didn't just say no, because I was always denying it. But to him, I couldn't lie. And I said, maybe. That maybe haunted me for a while. I called him a few times in moments of desperation to go to a meeting. I don't know why I thought it wasn't that I thought AA was going to be my solution. It was that I thought he could fix me. But he would always do what you're supposed to do, and he referred me to the schedule and recommended some meetings, and I just wasn't into that. I would look at the schedule, I would see all those addresses, and they wouldn't make any sense. I just wasn't ready. My brain wouldn't process that information. So after that attempt at finding God in the desert, in those last 2 months of trying to make it all work, I'd gotten so depressed that I couldn't get drunk anymore or high. I would drink a lot, and I would know that I was drunk because I would stand up and try and walk around and be incredibly dizzy, but I didn't have any of the fun feeling of it. And then on the 4th of July, which I didn't know it was the 4th of July, I saw all these fireworks and wondered what the hell was going on. A friend of mine had, I was hanging out with a friend of mine who had overdosed on heroin twice that month. His dog had run away. He'd been fired from his job as a wilderness rehab counselor. And my best thinking was, let's go to the bar and get drunk and you will feel better. and we went to a bar that only served beer, and we were both disgusted at that, and we went to another bar and just started drinking heavily. Drove home drunk, and the next day I asked my friend what else we could do for this guy before he got shipped away to rehab. Again, not making connections. I knew he was going to rehab. I did not think it was inappropriate to go to a bar. And my friend looked at me and just said, "You are in no position to help anybody." And it was a moment where I just could not argue with the truth of it. And I just sat there, stunned. And I called my friend and I asked him, differently this time, about AA. I said, "What meeting are you going to be at that I can meet you at?" And he told me about one the next day, and I showed up, and just as terrified as that Al-Anon meeting, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I knew, just like Jessica, I knew I was a drug addict. I didn't know that there was a label for it, but I knew I was a love addict. I knew I was an addict in that sense. I learned the label love addict later. And this was a closed meeting, and my friend told me that you're kind of supposed to only be an alcoholic, that you got to identify, and that there was this old-timer who usually comes but wasn't there that day who makes a big deal out of it. And so I was terrified. Like, I don't want to lie. And they were going around the room and introducing themselves, and it got to me, and I was torn between not wanting to lie and not wanting to be kicked out. And so I said it. I said, "I'm Jonathan, and I am an alcoholic," and I choked on the word. And it was a step study, and we were reading step three. And by the end of that meeting, I felt amazing. I still didn't identify as an alcoholic, but something in me said that I was doing the right thing, that it was the first right thing that I'd done to fix my life in a very, very long time, if ever. And I was just elated, and I told my friends, the people I lived with, who were the same people, because I didn't have any friends outside of that. When you drink a lot and you smoke a lot of pot, who needs other people? I also drank alone most of the time because bars are expensive and a waste of money and inefficient. But I'm not an alcoholic. I told them, and they pointed out that there was all this alcohol left in the house, and I said, "No, it's probably fine." The following Saturday after that first meeting, there were a bunch of people over. One of them asked me if I wanted to get high, and I said it probably wouldn't be appropriate because I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous now. And he said, "Come on, you know you want to." And I said, "Yes, I really do." And so I got high. And I got so high that I actually forgot for 4 months. For those 4 months, I thought I had two sobriety dates a week apart. And that was funny. But the day after that, I looked at all that remaining alcohol and thought, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. It probably isn't appropriate to have all of this. But my mom didn't raise me to waste, so I drank all of it. And went to my... And nothing interesting happened. But I went to my second meeting the next day, my sobriety date, and that old-timer who wasn't there the last week was there, and my friend wasn't. And I was pretty scared talking to him, but he asked me offhandedly, "Are you still drinking?" And I said, "Yes," really proudly, and told him about my plan that I had done. And he just looked at me with pity, and I couldn't argue with that look. I tried to. I said, "Well, no, you see, it's like to get rid of it." And then I thought, why didn't I throw it away? Why hadn't it ever occurred to me? And then we were reading the fourth step, and I was just having this overwhelming experience of awareness of myself. And the 12 and 12, the third and the fourth steps, they described the life that I was living, that it was just so hard and so lonely. And I was struggling not to cry. I didn't want to look weak in front of them, and I don't know. It was in that moment that the obsession to drink and to do drugs and to act on that love addiction, all that left me when I was confronted with the truth of what I was doing. And it was because I was just forced to realize that there was another thing inside me that used my voice and wore my skin and lived my life without my permission and had just destroyed it. It had robbed me of a life for 17 years. I never even had a chance. And I was just so filled with rage at that realization that I decided to commit to Alcoholics Anonymous. I started going to more meetings. I heard about sponsors, and I heard the word sponsor and that you're supposed to get one. So I asked somebody to be my sponsor, and then I asked him what that meant, and it just didn't matter. I did what I was told. That particular sponsor, it didn't work out, so I got another one. We met once a week, reading the book, doing a step when we got to it. Very, very simple. No forms or workbooks or any extra stuff like that. We just did what was in the book. And I don't want to knock on people who do it like that. I certainly did at the time because I thought that I was doing it the right way and everybody else was just deluded. Very closed-minded. And I started to wake up, and 3 or 4 months in, I realized that I had been an addict that whole time, for those 17 years instead of the 3 or 4. I also was realizing that I was having an easier time with life. I was able to do my job and not hate it. I was actually enjoying it for a minute. And I did my inventory, found what I think most people find, the same 3 or 4 tricks over and over again. I had wrapped all my behavior up in shame and self-pity and thought that I had just done all kinds of unspeakable things, and a lot of it is, you know, not something you mention in polite company, but I didn't invent anything. I guess that's my point. I told everything to my sponsor. He did not judge me, and I just started to have a spiritual awakening. Around 6 months, I did 5, 6, and 7. A friend I had met in the program asked me to sponsor him. He had 18 months at the time, but he liked the way that I'd done it, and I said sure. Ultimately, that didn't work out. Like I said, nobody I've sponsored has stuck around. I like to think that that's not my fault, because I don't consider myself powerful, able to make people sober or cause them to relapse. I'd gotten a sponsor because I didn't hear that any of that was optional. I got service positions, again, because I did not hear optional in the description of it. Our coins say unity, service, and recovery. They don't say if you feel like it and if you have time. I also heard I don't want to let the life that AA has given me get in the way of my life in AA, and so I just I dove completely in. It has worked out pretty well. I've had lots of ups and downs in AA. I have bipolar disorder, for which I take medication and I see a therapist. Our book says to do that. Seek the help of medical professionals. And there's even a whole pamphlet that says we have no opinion on outside issues like medications. And I'm very grateful for that, because some individuals have lots of opinions that I think that they should keep to themselves. Because that can be really dangerous if you say you're not sober if you're on medication. Well, I'm not alive if I'm not on the medication, so I'm going to go with the alive part. It's pretty hard to show up to a meeting if my heart isn't beating. So, that minor resentment aside, I used to hate hearing the 9-step promises because to me they were threats. They referred to coping mechanisms that had worked out very well for me that I did not want taken away. They were promises that were not going to come true. I couldn't stand to have my hopes built up just to be dashed again. But at this point, they have all come true. And I also used to hate hearing people say, I'm living a life beyond my wildest imagination, because I'd never imagined living a life worth anything. And yet it is true. The life that I have is pretty amazing. It's unrecognizable to the one that I had before. My parents say that often, like, what happened to our son? This is amazing. So I've gone incredibly over time, and thank you for indulging me. And if I've said anything that makes sense, I hope it is useful. What didn't make sense, this has been recorded, and you can re-listen to it again and figure it out, because I'm sure it was all brilliant on some level. Or not. Anyway, thank you. That is all.